Welcome to the Artificial Intelligence Podcast. My name is Lex Friedman. I'm a research scientist at MIT. If you'd like to skip ahead to the lecture Q&A with Mark Raybert, I start introducing him at about the two-minute mark. This podcast is an extension of the courses on deep learning, autonomous vehicles, and artificial general intelligence that I've taught and organized. It is not only about machine learning or robotics or neuroscience or philosophy or any one technical field. It considers all of these avenues of thought in a way that is hopefully accessible to everyone. The aim here is to explore the nature of human and machine intelligence, the big picture of understanding the human mind and creating echoes of it in the machine. To me, that is one of our civilization's most challenging and exciting scientific journeys into the unknown. Today is an excerpt from a lecture Q&A with Mark Raybert. That was part of the AGI course earlier this year. If you want to see the full video version, you can find it on my YouTube channel. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate it on iTunes or your podcast provider of choice, or simply connect with me on Twitter and other social networks at Lex Friedman, spelled F-R-I-D. Mark and his team at Boston Dynamics have built some of the most amazing robots ever created. For me, without exaggeration, meeting Spot Mini in person that day was one of the most transformative days of my life. I understood in a way I never have before that the possibilities of our work in AI and robotics are truly limitless.
Welcome back to 6S099, Artificial General Intelligence. Today, we have Mark Raybert. He is the founder and CEO of Boston Dynamics. He founded the CMU Leg Lab in 1980, the MIT Leg Lab in 1986, Boston Dynamics in 1992. He and his team have developed some of the most amazing robots ever built, including Big Dog, Atlas, Handle, Spot, Spot Mini. These robots move with the agility, dexterity, and even grace that rivals and often supersedes that of human movement. He continues to inspire us with what robots are capable of achieving in the real world and what physical form future intelligent systems may take as they become integrated in our daily lives. So please give Mark a warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. This is our grand mission, our aspiration, which is to make robots that are equal to or greater than people and animals. And it's, you know, it's a daunting mission because we're so good at things. It seems effortless. You know, I'm standing here. No one questions that I could stand here like this, but a lot's going on. I can manipulate things, I can pick up this water, or I could reach in my pocket and use my hands with all the sensors in my hands and coordinate that. And maybe most of all, our perception systems. You know, this audience has, 250 people in it or something? And I can look out there and see every one of you stabilized in space, even while I'm moving. It's just astounding. And, you know, robots aren't there yet. But I think they can be. And our goal is to keep chipping away to try and get there. Before I get started, I wanted to say that I got my start in robotics here at MIT. I was a graduate student. I was in the what was then called the psychology department, the brain and cognitive sciences department, but I was taking an IAP course, just like you are, and it might have been, you know, exactly this time of year when I followed one of my professor, Bertold Horn, back. I was jabbering away at him, asking him some questions about this or that, and we walked back to Tech Square, which is where the AI lab was in those days, and we went up to the ninth floor, and Russell Novsker, who was a guy working in the lab, had an arm all taken apart on the table. It was like 1,000 pieces, and I was a roboticist from that day on. I didn't switch my major, but I got Bertold to be an advisor. I found a topic that had to do with robotics. In that time, it was a manipulation thing, but eventually became legged thing. And it was amazing, you know, and I've never looked back.
Thanks for the presentation. It was amazing. What sort of physics simulation, if any, do you have in your robots? And do you really think that with the current trend of neural networks, we can just do end-to-end modeling of these robots without any sort of notion of physics, but just like neural networks?
So we have simulators that we've worked on for a long time, very detailed, in some cases validated. Validated mean compare the behavior of the simulator to the physics of ground truth. And, you know, I think they're important for our work, and we use them frequently, but the end-to-end doesn't ring quite true. Usually when we use simulation, the user is knowledgeable about the trade-offs between doing a physical experiment and doing a simulated experiment, and they're usually getting at some specific setup question, rather than the idea that you start at one end. You know, to at least in our experience, trying to simulate all the subtleties of the hydraulic actuator, backlashing gears, flexibility, you know, the non-rigidity in the components, that's a big undertaking and usually so distracting that you can't really get on with what you're doing. So I think we use experiment for those subtleties, and we use simulation for bigger level dynamics questions.
Hi, would you say mechanical concerns or computational capability is more of a difficulty in terms of determining how quickly you can perform tasks with the robots?
You know, we like to say that they're equally important. We now, although we didn't start out this way, we now have equal strength in our groups in the mechanical design and implementation and in the software and controls and sensing. And I think, you know, they all matter. I think if you try and get by with just marginally designed hardware, you don't get much experimental time in because the thing's broken all the time. So even though we are rough on our machines, they mostly keep working because we put a lot of, you know, attention to detail in how they're designed. But, you know, there's still I think perception is still a tall pole in the tent. Certainly, if you want to rival human perception, I don't think we're anywhere near there. I think the self-driving car stuff is helping. There's a lot of interesting things happen there. I think specialized hardware is getting, you know, ASICs and things that could help. But, you know, it's all still needed.
So you guys have developed like various components that all kind of come together to build one robot. Have you seen applications for any of these separate components elsewhere? So organic design, for example, for the Atlas, maybe prosthetics or hip replacements or something like that, because there seems to be a lot of development going on individually as well as in the big picture.
I mean, you're asking a very good question. There's a question, in case people couldn't hear, is aside from the value to the whole robot of the components we're making, are the components useful some other way? And, you know, the place where we think it's probably most true is the specialized hydraulic components we've made, servo valves and the HPU. I'm sure we could sell them into other industry. As a company focus question, though, that's really what it comes to. Do we really want to be doing that? Will that absorb too much time and attention and personnel? Or do we want to, you know, our heart is really in building, you know, future generations of robots. So I think we're going to probably stay there.
Thanks. I was wondering, have you done any research in regards to getting the robots to perform tasks involving direct physical contact with humans?
Nope. I can't. The only thing we've done is we've done teleoperation, which is not what you mean, where we have a human moving and the robot, you know, copying. Which is very interesting because you can see that's a way of showing how fast the robot can be and how coordinated it can be using a human for part of the computing. But we don't have them interacting with people. I guess the closest is we once did a thing where a person and a robot picked up a stretcher and worked together to pick up the stretcher, but they weren't touching each other. They were going through the stretcher material. Do we have plans? You know, we're really struggling with coming up with some strong concepts for safety, even without doing that. You know, robots, it's, you know, your first people's first reaction and how you make a robot safe if there's a problem don't really work very well. You can't freeze the robot. You have to find some, you have to keep them going, find a way to get into a safer state. So I think having them in contact with people is just going to be harder. So eventually we want to help, you know, to carry, lift the elderly and things like that, but we're not there yet.
My question is about the relative rates of progress in robotics and machine intelligence. So an economist might maybe measure it by seeing how much money is going into computing hardware versus arms and legs, sensors and actuators, that kind of thing. So in one possible scenario, the machine intelligence rushes ahead and the robots progressing more slowly because of kind of slow build test cycle, basically. They're real world things. It's not so easy to get a rapid build test cycle with a robot. And in the other scenario, the robots are more advanced than the machine intelligence because machine intelligence is just such a conceptually difficult problem. So in one scenario, the machines are telling the humans what to do. In the other scenario, the humans are telling the machines what to do, if you like. So do you have any kind of perspective on that whole issue? Are the machine intelligence folk going to rush ahead, leaving robots guys struggling behind, or are the robots going to get there before the massive problem of machine intelligence gets solved? Or maybe somewhere in the middle.
I think, I don't know exactly what you mean by machine intelligence. Are you talking about having Google do better search? Through intelligence?
Computation in general. So I, at the start, I talked about economists measuring sensors, actuators, and compute hardware. So that's the kind of split I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I think that it's always been a misconception that the hardware components by themselves constitute progress in intelligence or in robot behavior. I think they're important ingredients, but by themselves. You know, when I was a graduate student here, I can remember reading an ad for an optical character recognition system. And what the ad said was, you know, we have camera, we have a thing for holding the paper you're looking at, all you have to do is write the software. So it was all done except for you had to write the software. And, the whole problem was there. You know, robotics is hard. It feels like we're making progress. If you keep pushing, we keep making progress. It's not like there's a knee in the curve that we've hit. But I also think that the rest of the AI world is making good progress too, and it's fun being part of it.
My question is mostly related to security. So since you are productizing your robots now, there has been research on the LIDARs mainly, where you could spoof a LIDAR and the sensor basically cannot, you know, see anything. So are you looking into that as well, taking into consideration these awesome robots that you're building could be in, let's say, you know, defense, you know, working for the defense as well. So those are like really harsh environments.
Yeah, I mean, these are very hard problems. You know, if an intelligent adversary wants to trick the robot, it's not all that hard these days. You know, we're working probably the other end of the problem, you know, trying to do the basics right now. I don't think robots are going to be as autonomous in a hostile environment as people either think or fear because of how frail they'll still be until we get further along.
Hi there.
Hey.
I wanted to ask about two things that are going to probably play a big role in adoption. The first is price. So if you could speak to the current unit price of a Spot Mini and how that you think is going to evolve over time. And the second is sort of consumer psychology. I felt like when I saw the test at the end of the robot swearing, my level of comfort with it being in my house suddenly shot up. It seemed way more human. So I was just thinking about what kinds of experiments you guys have run or what you've thought about with respect to making people more comfortable with robots working around them.
In terms of cost, we're not saying what this thing costs yet, but we will later in the year. We have reduced the cost of this by about a factor of 10 from what the first prototypes cost. So we're making progress. In terms of the psychology of robots, it's been very interesting to watch. You know, we got branded sort of as robot abusers because we kicked our robot. Really what we were doing was trying to show how good they were at balancing, and we didn't think we were abusing them. I have video of me pushing on my daughter when she's 1 year old and actually knocking her over, but that wasn't my goal. I wanted to kind of test out her balance. And I bet you know, if you guys have kids or all that, you've done stuff like that. So, but we have adjusted a little bit, and so we don't usually push on the robots in our videos, despite the one we showed with Andy hockey sticking the hand on this thing. That's why we had the banana peels as a way to have the robot crash without us having our fingerprints on it. You know, I guess the other data point I have is that if you look at the likes and dislikes on our YouTube videos, we found a way to get the likes to dislikes ratio much higher by not looking like we're abusing the robots. There's probably a long way to go to make these things really friendly. And I have to admit there's a little spirit at our company of being kind of, it's fun being bad boys in terms of, just make the robot do cool stuff and leave the emotions to others. And certainly the social robots that have so much going into making them cute, I don't know. I'm sure we'll have marketing people working on that. I don't know what else to say.
Hi, I have a general question. So in terms of research purpose or like practical purpose, so what are the reasons that we choose to investigate on this humanoid robot? So it seems like it cannot run as fast as the cheetah, and it also cannot carry as many stuff as the big dog.
You're basically saying that the humanoids don't seem to be as practical in terms of functionality.
Right.
As the others.
Is it more efficient? Like are the humanoid robots more efficient than these cheetahs and the big dogs?
Well, So I don't have a good answer. The motivation for the DRC, the DARPA Robotics Challenge, which was humanoid robots, was to say that they wanted to use robots that could go to the places designed for humans. And so that's why they used the human form. And I think, there's an argument there. It is true that the human form has a lot of complexity to it because you have very complicated legs in the biped and they're supporting the weight of the body and the arms, whereas the quadrupeds can spread all that out. So I'm sympathetic to your question. I don't really have an answer. I can tell you that the public's reaction to a humanoid robot is off the scale compared to anything we've done with quadruped robots, for what that's worth. So we always get a lot of viewership if we show a humanoid doing something. But I think it's a question that we will keep addressing. We are going to keep pushing on getting the humanoid to do more and more human-like things, even though we probably won't commercialize them as soon as we commercialize the other stuff.
How do you specify goals? And although you said earlier that it's expensive to do like simulations and stuff, do you have any intentions of doing any deep reinforcement learning?
What was the last thing you said?
Do you have any intentions of doing deep reinforcement learning?
I'll do the last one first. I'm sure we will use learning before too long. I'm not sure whether it'll be deep reinforcement learning or something else, but mostly we're interested in optimizing the complicated state space partitioning we do. Right now we use, people make very simple decisions as to how to divide up the space. And we think that these things could probably be really improved if we use the learning approach. So that's probably the first place we'll apply it. We do a little bit of learning here and there, but not much compared to how much learning is talked about out there. What was the other question? How do we specify a goal? You mean to the robot or how do we decide as a company? So I don't think there's any across-the-board answer. We write applications, for instance, for each of these uses. So, for instance, in the where we were doing the patrol route, we have an application that has a UI that lets the user, tell it the information it needs. It can tell it to go ahead and start on the patrol and things like that. For the door, I think there's a button on the controller. We can show you afterwards if you want. And you walk the robot up to the door with you steering it, and then you press the button, and then it starts looking for the door handle, and it goes through the door.
Train
But I don't think these answers are fundamental. I think you could do it lots of different ways. You know, we're working on all the machinery coming up from the bottom to be able to do these things. And then, you know, in some case, you could have it be buttons on a UI. It could be an API that's accessed through some higher level AI. And we just aren't sweating that part of it at this point.
Hi. So aside from locomotion, I can use my body for, like, you know, nonverbal communication to communicate my intentions and other such things, even though I'm not always aware of it. And I guess I'm wondering if this is something that you've considered for these robots.
I think the closest we've come is having the robot go like this after the flip, which was a way of communicating. We really haven't done anything along those lines. I'll bet you, though, the people writing code can interpret a lot of the subtleties of what's working and what isn't by looking at things like that, but the robot isn't trying to communicate that way.
I have two questions. How do you make the robots really fast?
How do we make them fast?
No, my question is, how did you make them fast? I mean, like, the time, how?
We get a lot of people who are really smart and good at working together with each other at our lab. And then they make plans, and everybody tries to stay on the plan, and then, pull it together. Sometimes it doesn't go as fast as we like, especially if we have to buy parts from someone else and they're slow. That happens a lot. No, honestly. Is that what you mean? So we don't make them that fast. You know, we're pretty fast. You know, usually 4 or 5 months to build a new robot, something like that. But mostly it's getting people to work together. What's the other question?
The other question is, why do the people push the robots?
Why do they push? The robots are always balancing themselves. And so we want to show that they can balance by showing that when you knock them, they don't fall over, they stay up on their feet. So we're kind of showing off. Are you building anything? Why not?
I don't know.
You should.
It's way off.
What?
Way off.
Where? In the basement?
I'm not good at building.
No? Yes, you are. You might think you're not.
Well, in some games there are.
You ought to give it a try. And
really?
You're the right age to get started.
I'm 6 and a half.
Perfect.
With that, I think, okay. Please give Mark a big hand.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.